Good evening. My name is Fabio Licinius, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum, the Department of Political Science, and the Department of Film Studies, I would like to welcome you to this evening's program, The Obama Election. Barack Obama shattered more than 200 years of history on November 4, 2008, when he won the presidential election and became the first African-American president of the United States. Campaigning as an agent for change, Obama defeated Republican presidential candidate John McCain by 6 percentage points. Throughout the general campaign, Obama drew crowds of tens of thousands of people to hear him speak. The historic nature of the 2008 election was reflected in the fact that 54% of the population voted, which is the highest voter turnout since 1972. As expected, Obama won overwhelmingly among African-American voters and also women and Latino voters. Young voters, those under the age of 30, also contributed greatly to his victory. Obama succeeded in winning battleground states such as Ohio, Pennsylvania, and states with larger electoral votes such as Massachusetts, Michigan, New Jersey, and New York. In his speech on Victory Night, Obama said, "If there is anyone out there who doubts that America is a place where anything is possible, who still wonders if the dream of our founders is alive in our time, who still questions the power of our democracy, tonight is your answer." We're fortunate to have with us tonight film director and producer Alicia Sams. Sams has extensive experience making both documentary and fiction films. She began her career working on documentaries for Bill Moyers. Sam was post-production supervisor for Chocolat, The Shilping News, and Original Kings of Comedy. In 2006, she produced two feature-length documentaries, Wanderlust and Toots, and was executive producer of the documentary Amigra, released in 2009. Sam's most recent film as director is By the People, The Election of Barack Obama. This documentary was premiered in 2009 on HBO and chronicles the journey of Barack Obama on his presidential campaign to the White House. At this time, I would like to remind you to please turn off all cell phones and other electronic devices. Also, since this program is being taped and some of our audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait for a microphone to reach you before asking your question during the question and answer session at the end of this program. Thank you, and please join me in welcoming Alicia Sams.
So, hello everyone. I'm really happy to be here. I've enjoyed my 2 days here at Dickinson. I've met a lot of students and been really impressed, so thank you all very much for having me, especially Harry for inviting me to the Clark Forum, and my sister Victoria, my sister Professor Sams for helping to arrange so much. I'm going to tell you a little bit about how I got involved in this project before I launch into sort of talking about the campaign, because it's the first question everybody asks me, how did you get Barack Obama to let you follow him around? And the trick was we started really, really early. Amy Rice, my co-director, came to me in the fall of 2005. She'd seen the 2004 speech he gave at the DNC, which I had also seen, but she saw it and immediately thought, what a great guy this would be for a documentary, and started trying to get in the door to start shooting him, and she wasn't really getting anywhere, so she came to me and she came to her friend Edward Norton, and we all teamed up, and Edward got us in the door, and we said, let's just see how it goes. We're really interested in your path as a senator. I personally was very excited about it because I'd been coming off a lot of music and cultural documentaries and was feeling as if the sort of the 90s and 2000s, there had been a lot of apathy kind of around American politics and citizenship. And when I saw Obama's speech in 2004, I felt, well, this was a real call to action and call to get involved again in our democracy. And I thought, well, if we make films while he's in the Senate, there'll be like little lessons in citizenship. And in 8-10 years when he runs for president, we'll be there. We'll know him really well, and we'll be able to do this in the tradition of great political documentaries. So we began, and I thought it would be kind of funny. I went back and looked at our original proposal to read you a couple of lines from it. We were fascinated by where he came from. We had not seen a politician that kind of combined so many disparate elements into his background. So we wrote him and we said, this documentary will both explore Senator Obama's unique personal history and the development of his career as a politician. We will show what made him the leader he is today and follow his journey in the Senate as he develops his own style of progressive yet pragmatic politics. And we said at the end, moreover, we would like to make a documentary about Senator Obama because we believe at some point he will make a run for our nation's highest office, and we hope to be there when he does. But we went on to say that unlike other political documentaries, however, we'll show politics in process. We're not making a campaign documentary. Well, 1 year later, we were making a campaign documentary. But we began very humbly. We began in the Senate. He had a small office and a small staff, and we would shoot him doing his podcasts, and we followed him to a couple of speeches and a graduation address. We could tell that he was a little frustrated with the pace of things in the Senate and being this junior senator, but he was, you know, pretty diligent, and he would show up and do his part. But it wasn't that exciting. It was interesting, but it wasn't really that exciting. And then we went on the road with him. And actually, the most interesting thing he did in the Senate was on Thursday mornings, he and Dick Durbin would have a constituent coffee. And people, visiting groups from Illinois would come, and they'd get to ask questions of their senator. And I was like, oh, that really is democracy in action. You know, it does still happen that way. So that was kind of interesting to see. But it wasn't until we went back to Illinois in the summer with him, and there's a parade called the Bud Billiken Parade on the south side of Chicago, and that was when we first saw sort of Barack Obama, the rock star, begin to emerge, because these constituents loved him, and they were all saying, this was the summer of 2006, run for president, run for president. And then I went downstate Illinois with him. And that was, that's mostly farmers, mostly Republicans, but also his constituents once he won the election. And he would go down there and he'd say, look, I know most of you didn't vote for me, but I'm your senator now, so I'm here to listen to you. Tell me what you're worried about. Tell me what you're thinking about. And he would have these one-on-one conversations. You know, people would ask questions, and he would really engage them. And that's when I began to see that this man had a future in being able to reach out to all different kinds of people. And what was interesting was that I think people projected themselves onto him. Even a 65-year-old white farmer in southern Illinois saw a little bit of himself in this 44-year-old African-American because he would listen to them. And I think that that was maybe new and unusual for them to really feel like they were being listened to. So we began to see kind of what all this fuss was about. You don't see it so much in Washington, but you really do see it out on the trail. And then we knew that if this thing was going to work, he was going to Africa that summer for 2 weeks. So we figured if we could get on that trip, spend 2 weeks with him and his staff, and come away from it not hating each other, we'd probably have a shot at staying on the road with him. And so we went to Africa, and South Africa was interesting because no one knew who he was. But Kenya, they were welcoming home their native son, and they said, you know, you will run for president of America, and you will be our president too. And the crowds were astonishing. And that's when we first began to hear talk. Once we got to Kenya, the international journalists trickled in, the New York Times and Time and Newsweek and various pundits, and up till then it had just been Chicago Press. That's when we first began to hear talk that maybe 2008 this guy was going to do it, you know, and that was sort of the favorite late night after the day conversation in the hotel bar. Is he going to do it? Is he not going to do it? And we had a lot of fun debating that back and forth, actually. Got back from Africa. His book, The Audacity of Hope, came out. We went on book tour with him, and that's when we really saw Barack Obama, the rock star. He combined, very cleverly, combined his book tour with campaigning for other candidates in the 2006 midterm elections. Starting to gain favor, you know, gain points with other candidates, though not all of them supported him in 2008, which was kind of a disappointment to him, but they came around eventually. And again, he was treated like a rock star. People came out to hear what he had to say. His book signing events, there were lines out the door. It was exciting to see how many people wanted to hear about democracy again, wanted to become engaged again, and didn't know that much about him, but knew that something was there. So the midterms actually went really well, and our film actually opens with the midterm elections when he says, you know, I love elections, especially when I'm not on the ballot. 3 months later, he was made his announcement in Iowa that he was going to run for, I mean, I'm sorry, he made his announcement in Springfield, Illinois, that he was going to run for President of the United States of America. I wanted to talk tonight almost exclusively about Iowa. You're free to ask me questions about anything, but I think Iowa is certainly the most unusual part of the film because it's a part of the process that people don't usually see. It was a revelation to me. I mean, I'm not a political scientist. I knew that the Iowa caucuses were important, but I didn't realize how much FaceTime Iowans get with the candidates. And luckily, they take it very seriously. They take that responsibility very seriously. And as Obama likes to say, they really kick the tires and look under the hood and really put these guys in. You know, a lot of people don't decide until a couple days before the caucus who they're going to caucus for. And they go back and forth. And sometimes you feel like they're just toying with the candidates because they want another visit. But I think they truly are trying to parse, you know, who's the right guy. And who are the Iowans going to get behind? And so it was really fascinating to see. It gave us an opportunity to see a lot of the other candidates on the ground and get sort of up close and personal with them. We shot everything. We thought it would all be in the film. We have 700 hours of footage that hopefully will become part of the historic record because it obviously didn't make it all into the film. But if any of you students are interested in campaigns and interested in the political process on that level, I would say 2010. Well, it won't be. Next time there's incumbent, go to Iowa because it is fascinating. Volunteer for someone or get a job for someone. And it's an amazing experience. So anyhow, the reason I picked Iowa too was because the campaign strategy to begin with was very simple. They knew that if they could win Iowa, they had a shot. If they didn't win Iowa, he probably didn't have a chance. Hillary Clinton, with her recognition and with her fame, could afford to lose Iowa and still win the nomination. John Edwards probably could as well. But Barack Obama, even though he seemed like he was becoming this rock star, he still wasn't a household name. We would go and talk to people. We would do man-on-the-street interviews even after he announced, and people would still be like, yeah, I think I've heard of him. But as Axelrod said on election night, let's face it, you got a guy named Barack Hussein Obama. Why wouldn't you be, why would you be confident? So it was a challenge. They knew they had a challenge. And so they focused everything they had on Iowa. And they got a lot of really great young people to work for them, and they sent them out to these small towns, and they coached little league teams, and they went and had coffee houses every couple of weeks and met constituents and began talking to them about why they were working for Barack Obama and recruiting people slowly to caucus for him. It was the biggest organization, I think, that ever had hit the ground in Iowa. I mean, it grew, obviously, from the beginning. It caught the Clinton campaign totally flat-footed. They were way behind in getting their organization on the ground. I mean, obviously they started out ahead, but they were woefully unprepared. People who had been around on several campaigns told me, well, you know, when we signed up to work, got our jobs with Barack Obama, our friends on the Clinton campaign were basically sending us letters of condolence. Like, I'm sorry, you're not with us. And So they started out thinking they had it in the bag, and the Obama people started out the underdogs, knowing that they were going to have to work for every caucuser they could get. Edwards had been in the state since late 2004, just showing up. A lot of people knew who he was, you know, obviously from the 2004 campaign, but he never left Iowa. He would just kept showing up, building support sort of quietly, you know, talking to a lot of farmers who really responded to his populist message. Chris Dodd moved to Iowa and put his kid in school there in the fall of 2007. So there was a lot of competition for caucusers. I keep wanting to say votes. But I want to show you a clip now. This is announcement day in Springfield, and after he announced in Springfield really early on a cold, cold morning, and then we all got on the plane to Iowa and did this sort of five-city tour where we spoke in these arenas. And it began in this really big, exciting way because they were packed. And so we thought, wow, this is a campaign. This is really big. This is really exciting. He was still a little green, you'll see, as he sort of fumbles around backstage looking for his notes. And the reason I want to show you this is it's exciting to see where it all began, but it's also kind of interesting because the next time we went back to Iowa, it wasn't like that at all. You know, it was small crowds with 30, 40 people, and that was what Iowa really is. So this is not in the film. Of course, we always thought we'd open with his announcement, but it became less important as time went on. But it's a fun clip nonetheless. And after this clip, I think I'll take some questions before we move on to sort of spring in Iowa.
And did you plan for all this starting this early?
No one did. No one did. No.
So how did it kind of come about that it became so early?
When you say early, do you mean the whole process?
Yeah, I mean in terms of...
You guys started.
Okay.
these things were nice and docile until the media got involved.
Wonderful to be back in Springfield, especially when you're seeing all these good friends.
There's no title for the speech. It's just announcement speech. But now that you said that, now I'm starting to worry.
Well, somebody will pick a phrase, right?
Somebody will pick a phrase. A couple lines that we like are, he ends the speech with one of the last lines of the Gettysburg Address, without specifically quoting it, which is kind of nice sometimes. But, you know, together, let us begin the work that will usher in a new birth of freedom on this earth.
This is a historical moment. I wanted to be part of it. I've been an Obama supporter since I read his first book. Didn't realize there was going to be this many people here, though.
I heard about it when I was in Africa. I didn't come in the United States before. And when he speak in the Democratic National Convention in 2004, that was my first time. And I realized that he can go far.
Join me at this moment in history and welcome Barack Obama. Because you believe in what this country can be. And that is why, in the shadow of the old state capitol, where Lincoln once called on a house divided to stand together, I stand before you today to announce my candidacy for President of the United States of America.
happening in here?
We've been sitting in a bus.
They shower us down in here first, and then we go out.
Strength search.
Hey, guys. I just came by to say hi. No quotes.
I owe you. John, my son.
Good. It's been a good day. Is there anything? Pretty good visual. You must have gotten some decent shots this morning.
It's cold.
It's freezing. You and me, we got no body fat. This is like the most embarrassing thing, but I always lose stuff.
Oh, I can imagine.
Hold on.
Oh, there you go.
Let's see, I got these. Poor thing. You should have to do that twice.
You just lose.
Hold on, it's around here somewhere.
What did we lose?
Sorry.
You mean the wrist.
I noticed that Emily's pretty patient right here. She's like,
Emily's like, you idiot.
Too many pockets.
She's not. Here it is.
One of the pockets.
That's it. I'm told.
All right.
You guys got a lot of stuff.
You got the supporter card.
Clean out your pockets, son.
Hey, everybody. I just wanted to say thank you so much for...
Sorry. That's a good look at Barack Obama's secret weapon, which is Michelle Obama, who keeps him honest at every turn, too. I forgot to point out my favorite thing to watch for in this clip, which is Jon Favreau mouthing the words to the speech. That became one of my favorite things to look for when Obama was giving speeches. I'd try and find John and see if he was mouthing it along with him, and invariably he was. So Favreau is a pretty amazing guy. He was only 27 then and was working with Obama to write these amazing speeches. And he's now head speech. I think he's the youngest head speechwriter. He was the youngest on a campaign. I think he's the youngest one in the White House as well. Though he does have an office in the basement. With a very low ceiling. So that's how it all began. In Iowa, the press on the plane, very exciting. You know, Joe Klein from Newsweek and Dan Balls from the Washington Post and Maureen Dowd. And it was big stuff, CNN and... The next time we went to Iowa, it wasn't quite like that. But before I move on, I wondered if anybody had any questions about sort of the early part of the campaign and the film. Could you bring up the house lights, please, so that we can see if anyone has any questions?
You spoke about before, as you were watching him as a senator, kind of debating whether... it was his turn to run, or whether he was ready or not. Could you speak? I guess I'm curious as how he got some of the heavy hitters, political hitters, Axelrod, Gibbs, to also kind of see that spark in him when, obviously, so many people thought Edwards, Dodds, people with a lot higher name recognition. Why didn't they back that candidate? I guess I'm also curious about like the maturation of the young senator to.
To get those,
Something like that.
Well, Gibbs was with him from 2004 and was his head of communications in the Senate. So Gibbs signed on really early, and Gibbs had actually been—he actually hadn't been fired from the Kerry campaign, but his boss was fired and he quit. And Gibbs got really lucky, signed on in 2004 with this young senator to be his communications guy, and Gibbs is one of his closest advisors now, which is a really unusual position for a press spokesman to be in. And in the beginning of the campaign, on this trip, he was obviously there. He wasn't on the road with him, and that quickly changed. Obama really needed him on the road with him because he was savvy and he was good with the press, even though he frustrated the hell out of them, and us included. And so he was in from the beginning, and he really grew into that role. He's young. I mean, he's in his 30s, and he hadn't really ever done anything quite like this before. Axe had also signed on to the Senate campaign, but Obama had to win him over to that, though Axe doesn't like to. I mean, I can't remember the story, actually, how Axe, at what point. I think it might have been the speech that he gave on the war that convinced Axe that this guy could make it as a senator. And I don't think Axe was part of the push to have him run. I think, though, when it became apparent that all these forces were aligning, that it seemed like the right time, that there wasn't going to be an even with Hillary as this front runner that seemed like, a lion that you could never bring down, too many people wait too long to run. And if he didn't take this opportunity, it could be another 8, 10, 12 years, and he was never going to be sort of as hot as he was at that time. So the we didn't shoot this, but what happened was that fall, when things were going so well on the midterm elections, and Axe was working for a lot of other candidates in the midterms, and Obama was speaking for them, he called together Axe and Gibbs and Valerie Jarrett and a couple of friends from law school, Julius Genachowski, who's now FCC chair, Cassandra Butts, who was working at the Center for John Podesta's organization, and they hashed it out, and they thought about, he didn't make the decision until Christmas, because Michelle was really the ultimate. That the family, what it would do to the family, was sort of the biggest factor. But they hashed it out, all these scenarios. Should we do it? Should we not do it? Is this the right time? What would it take? And what would it do to me? And Pluff, Axe and Pluff had this company together. Pluff didn't want to work on a campaign. He had a young kid. And Obama just wouldn't take no for an answer from Pluff. I think once they decided that he wanted a campaign, and Pluff had sort of been working in this advisory role, he's like, I really want you to run it. I want you to run it. Axe and Pluff had both worked, I think, on the Edwards campaign before he lost to Kerry in 2004. Pluff wanted to sit this one out. He wanted to spend time at home. It's grueling to run a presidential campaign. But once Barack Obama just sets his mind to something, he's a hard guy to say no to, unless you're a Republican senator. So I don't know. Does that answer your question? Any others before we move on to someone? Okay.
Thank you. What was the reasoning behind the correct terminology, but kind of the grassroots way to run the campaign of like really rallying the common people, like really getting common citizens involved,
mm-hmm.
and not only creating a lot of hype and a lot of excitement about voting, but actually getting involved in the campaign and spreading the word and encouraging others?
That comes straight out of Barack Obama's roots as a community organizer. When he first came, his first job out of college, he was like working for some bank, sort of business analytical stuff, and he didn't like it. So he ended up getting this job working for a community organizer, Jerry Kelman and Mike Kralik, who were in Chicago. And he learned, and actually it's interesting because he learned this methodology that a man named Saul Alinsky wrote about trying to community organizing. The basis of it is you talk to people, you try to figure out what their interests are, and then you try to align their self-interest with whatever the cause is that you're trying to, whether it's bringing recycling to the neighborhood, you try to figure out why they would be interested in that, and you make them see that it's in their self-interest, and then you get them to agitation. Hillary Clinton wrote her senior thesis on Saul Alinsky as well. So it's kind of interesting that they both had this interest in community organizing. So grassroots movements is the basis of that. And they ran, in the summer of 2007, they ran something called Camp Obama, which trained young people that were both volunteers and going to work for the campaign as paid staff in this community organizing technique. And I remember Mike Kralik saying to these people, and they ran them successively over the summer. I mean, I think thousands of people went through this, and then they started fanning out all over the country, teaching people how to go into the community, talk to people, listen to people. The key is listening and hearing what they're interested in, and then trying to figure out what part of the campaign that they would respond to the most. You know, oh, you're interested in healthcare. Well, let me talk to you about Barack Obama's plan for healthcare, as opposed to going in and just lecturing on why Obama's a great guy, really figuring out what people's interests are. And Plouf knew that since nobody knew who this guy was, he needed hundreds of thousands of people to go out into communities and tell people who he was and identify why they would be interested in. And it was an exceptionally well-run campaign in that way, because they trained both staff and volunteers, and they were really disciplined. They were just really well organized. And it comes from that community activism. Okay, shall we move on to spring in Iowa? Okay, so that frenzy was really fun, and we thought, this is really great. We got on the plane. We didn't have to put our tray tables up for takeoff. We could, we got free snacks. It's really fun. We're meeting all this press. This is what it's going to be like for the next year and a half, right? Well, not exactly. that was just to make a big splash for the first trip to Iowa. The next time we went back, and there's a reporter from the New York Times named Jeff Zeleny who had covered Obama for the Chicago Tribune, covered the whole first year. Came to Africa with us, and he's the one that told us, spend as much time in Iowa as you possibly can. So we decide to go when there's downtime, when nothing big is happening. We'll go a couple days while they're setting up the office, and Obama's going to come in later and do some campaigning. So this is in April. His press secretary from D.C., Tommy Vitor, who's also young, Jon Favreau's best friend, got the job of press secretary in Iowa. And we said to Tommy, why would you want to go to Iowa? Why don't you go to Chicago, to headquarters? Headquarters is going to be so exciting. And he said, you don't understand. Iowa is where it is all going to happen. And Tommy's sole focus for almost a year was getting Iowa press. The national press would come to do a story, and they would get in line behind not only the Des Moines Register, but the Marshalltown Sentinel and the tiny little radio station from some other tiny town in Iowa. The guy who writes for the Burlington Times. I mean, they and it would frustrate them, but Tommy's like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what the national press says. All that matters is what's happening in Iowa, and then Iowans get to know this guy. And it was interesting because if you watched, and this next clip doesn't show that. It's a clip after this. If you were following the campaign that early, what you saw in the national press was stories about the national polls. Hillary's way ahead. This guy doesn't have a chance. This guy doesn't have a chance. And it was very hard for the campaign to manage fundraisers' expectations that he should be doing better, and donors' expectations and bundlers' expectations. He should be doing better in the national polls. And they kept saying, no, 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 we know what we're doing. We have a plan. We're going to win Iowa. Don't worry about the national polls. They don't matter. No one's voting now. But this became the story in the national press for much of 2007. And what we tried to do was cover the story on the ground in Iowa to see how slowly but surely these kids, mostly kids, were building a grassroots constituency for Obama. So I put together a little bit of sort of spring in Iowa. It kind of shows you a little bit about how grueling it was, how he didn't really have his sea legs at first. He looks a lot younger, I think, than he does today. And then the Polk County Democrats dinner, which about 4 out of the 8 candidates at the time showed up for to give speeches. And it just kind of gives you a sense of how hands-on things are in Iowa at this point. And then I think, so I'm going to show you that, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about the next one, and then we'll stop again for questions. So, what you missed was him just saying, hello, everybody. It's going to cut into the beginning of the clip. Oops. Wrong button. I know there should be an exit button. Return to quit. Thank you. Does anybody know what return is? If I do it on the near side. What if I just do this? No, that's language.
I think enter is.
No, that's. Yeah. No, I know. I'm just looking for the right button to push. And no, I already tried enter. Let's just try. Play? Come on, quit. Anybody up there know what to do? Yeah. And now I changed it to French. Turn it off. Good idea. Doesn't even want to turn off. Okay. Oh, wait, I found it. All right. Well, I won't make that mistake again. Now I'm going to have to fast forward. Come on, fast forward. Does anybody know how to... Can you send that guy down? There we go. Sorry, it should be able to go faster than this, but it's not. So I'll tell you a little bit more about the Polk County dinner. This is just a funny little anecdote. That was the first time we saw John Edwards. And we were very excited to see John Edwards because we liked what he had to say, and we thought, oh, this will be really interesting. And look for a moment when John Edwards sees us It instantly turned us off to John Edwards, and we were not surprised when the rumors popped up about him and his videographer. What else happened that day? The people that were out there cheering so hard for Biden and dissing all the other candidates couldn't wait to get their picture taken with every candidate that showed up. That was pretty funny. you'll see the Hillary campaign sort of caught flat-footed by the Obama campaign's cheers. A lot of early Iowa campaigning is sort of like a high school pep rally. And at one point, they did the H-I-L-L, you know, give me an H, give me, and they spelled her name wrong. And there was one kid that caught it and was like trying to stop, you know, no, no, no. So there's a lot of kind of, there's a lot of kind of great moments of democracy in action where people are just out there kind of getting to know the candidates, getting to know each other, trying to figure out what they're, it's fun. Okay, we're almost there. It's another good chance to see Michelle's expression. That's how she'd be looking at me right now, too.
Hey, everybody. I just wanted to say thank you so much for, although, you know, this isn't a bad day to be outside. I just want to let it all be known. I want to shake hands with everybody.
Hi.
Hey, Kim.
Very nice
good
to meet
see you.
Welcome to Iowa.
How are you?
Good.
Running for president is like being an astronaut. You can go in the simulator all you want, but until you're orbiting in space, you don't really know what it's going to be like.
I've been shaking hands for 3 straight hours. Straight. You have to kill me. I'm physically spent. I don't know how I'm going to give a speech. It's like I've been through a wrestling match.
Sorry.
Marvin.
Yes, sir.
You all are killing me, man. What's that? I've been shaking hands 3 hours straight.
We're early, though. Come
on. We're early.
Early, though.
Got a lot more hands shaking this thing.
Morning again.
Good to see you.
Oh, jeez.
I-O-W-A, Barack Obama all the way. I-O-W-A, Barack Obama all the way.
Do you think this country is ready to elect the first African-American president?
No.
Sure.
No.
Not even Colin Powell. He would get elected.
That's a different story. But he's smart enough to know not to run.
Right now, I have to say that I'm looking at Edwards. I would like to see Richardson.
I don't like any of the candidates. I don't think any of them are the right people. I think Hillary's been around too long. She doesn't stand for anything anymore. Obama's wonderful, but he's just a little too young and untried. Of course, after Bush, anybody can be president. I can be president.
We loved our people on the street interviews because we always got really great comments. That the guy that's telling him you got a lot more hands to shake in the state is Marvin Nicholson, who worked on the Kerry campaign. He'd been a caddy at a golf course on Nantucket when he met John Kerry, and Kerry's like, "Hey, come be my body man." And the body man is the guy that like does everything for the candidate, makes sure he has whatever it is he likes to drink, makes sure he's got all his stuff together. And that the body man for Obama is a guy named Reggie Love, who's really great. But Marvin was his trip director. And Marvin had been through this before, so he was great at sort of coaching the staff along and what to expect. But I like that clip because it just shows you a little bit about how it all begins. The next clip is in the summer. The crowds are getting a little bit bigger, but there's still not a lot of movement. The national polls are still a story for the national press, even though the local press don't care about it. And this is the Iowa State Fair, which is the most important summer event. All the candidates show up, and they all speak at different times, and they stand on hay bales, and people come and hear them, and it's hot, and it's steamy, and everything is fried, and You can get pork chops on a stick, and which are really good, actually. And it's just, it's this kind of, but everybody goes, and everybody has to go, and everybody speaks to the people, and I just, this is actually in the film, but I love this because it's a really great look at Iowa and what the candidates sort of do to get elected there. So I'm going to show this really briefly and talk some questions, and then we'll skip to sort of the Iowa turning point. I forgot to tell you what to look for in this clip. The main, you'll see Tommy Vitor, who's a young press secretary, and his main goal from the time we got to the state fair was to get Obama to this corn kernel station where they had a corn kernel poll where you were supposed to go by and put a corn kernel in the jar of the candidate that you were supporting at that time. In time to do a local radio interview. And he was sweating bullets because, of course, the minute we got there, Obama wanted to go on rides with his kids and wanted to do, you know, he wanted to have fun at the fair. And the press was like there was a lot of press that time because it was one of their first big bus tours. So they were just all over him, and the crowds were unbelievable, and everyone was hot and in a bad mood, and Tommy was just trying to figure out how he was going to get Obama to show up because it was live, you know, on time to do this interview. So that's kind of the backstory going on as we make our way through the state fair.
Over Barack Obama, is she the inevitable nominee? Is Hillary Clinton got this thing locked?
Good job. Right, you know, you can't
stand the heat. Get out of the kitchen. Finally. Do you want an update? I'm trying to get him on TV. I'm a local NBC affiliate, live at 6. But I have no clue where we're going to be, where we are now, how long it's taking to get there. Literally on our way out.
Hey, I'm Tommy.
Oh, hey, Tommy.
Tommy Vitor?
Yeah.
Just got done from the Boston Globe. Hey, man.
How are you?
I've been reading you forever. I've been, you know, swearing about Boston sports. I'm fun.
Back
way to stick it to us on that crap lobbying story.
Yeah, I know you wouldn't like that.
That's such bullshit. When are we going to move past the gotcha story?
Oh, come on. That was
bullshit. Here's the reason it's a bullshit story.
Sandy? Sir, we did two. Is that okay?
Yesterday was Dave's birthday. Okay.
I'm going to fast forward because I didn't edit this properly. Just to see you, the corn kernel bit. Faster. Why will you not go fast?
Good job, Hillary. Good job.
That's right. You know, you can't stand the heat. Get out of the kitchen.
There we go. I'm not very good technically. These days, to be a filmmaker, though, you should be very good technically. I did, though, one interesting thing when we started the film was that Amy and I decided, she was already a cinematographer, we knew that the only way that we could maintain the intimacy that we wanted and also keep the cost down was to do this completely by ourselves. So I learned to do sound, and we became a two-woman team. And then after Super Tuesday, I learned to shoot, and we split up so we could cover people.
Now, as you may see here, sir, you're getting out-jarred.
Excuse me, everybody. I need everybody to get a corn kernel and start filling up a jar. You don't want me to be behind. It's heartbreaking. So we need to catch up. By Sunday, we're going to have overtaken all the other candidates when it comes to their corn kernels. All right? Do I have a commitment? Got some. Thank you, guys.
Okay. So that's the making of a president. It begins with corn kernels in Iowa. Before anybody on the national stage knows who he is. So I'd like to take another round of questions.
When did Hillary know that there was trouble?
In the fall, she was still ahead enough in the national polls. She actually stayed ahead in the national polls. But she got a sense, actually, you know, I think that they still took Iowa for granted up until the Jefferson Jackson dinner, which is the next clip I'm going to show, which is in November. And that is the big, every state has a Jefferson Jackson dinner where they raise money for their party. But that was actually, interestingly, Kerry's turning point in 2004 as well. Every candidate gives a speech and they work so hard on that speech. And Obama just knocked it out of the park. And the momentum changed after that weekend. But they were able to capitalize on that because they had that ground game in place and there. And you know, Hillary had lined up all the best operatives. And she had the support of a lot of people. And slowly that fall, Obama was getting, you know, the endorsement of the mayor of Des Moines. The early guy that endorsed him was the attorney general of Iowa. But the governor, Chet Culver, endorsed Hillary. Even up to a couple weeks before the caucus, the Des Moines Register endorsed Hillary. But she started to realize she was in trouble in November. No more.
I was wondering if you could comment a little bit on the media's role in throughout the campaign, maybe the pros and cons and just stuff that you observed throughout your filming.
Yeah, you know, the it's interesting because what we tried to do in the film was stay away from the daily news cycle. But obviously, because we were with the media all the time, it was very difficult for us to stay away from the daily news cycle. And I try now also to do the same thing. The media has become more a place of opinion, I think, than of news. And some of them lament this, but they are under so much pressure to blog, to put video up, to take pictures, to constantly have something to say, even when there's no news, that they kind of have to become sort of, who was it that was called the bloviator? I can't remember. But it's not that they're stupid, and it's not that there are certainly rabble-rousers out there that just like to hear themselves talk, but a lot of these people are really dedicated people who have been through this cycle a lot, who sort of lament the days of a slower-paced media. In this early in the election, the campaign didn't really care that much about them because the national media wasn't going to do anything for them. All they really cared about was what the Iowa media would do for them. And so they gave them time and they gave them interviews and they talked to their editorial boards. Later they kicked in and started talking to the national media's editorial boards. But I remember certain of the shows, like Chris Matthews, was just frustrated to death that Obama wouldn't go on Hardball during the Iowa caucuses. So when that happens, when the candidates aren't paying attention to them, they begin to just sort of talk about whatever they can think of to talk about. And invariably, it was the polls and the lack of movement in the national polls and the fact that, you know, nobody knew who he was and how was he going to get anywhere, you know. Hillary, 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 Hillary was, you know, Hillary, the Clintons dominated the Democratic Party so much that no one thought he could take them down. And I don't know if that really answers your question. That's a topic. It's fascinating, and it's also, the media looks at itself a lot now, too, and I think is trying to figure out what its future is. One thing that was making a lot of people nervous on this campaign was how much money that everybody had to spend because it went on so long. And a lot of people lost their jobs after the campaign because they couldn't afford to hang on, which was really unfortunate. Any other questions?
You just stated how that nobody thought that he could actually overtake Hillary. When you first joined the campaign, did you believe that he would be able to win the nomination?
I didn't know. And what we convinced ourselves of was that we had a really, we knew we wanted to be with Obama for the long haul no matter what. And we knew that we would have an interesting film someday. If he didn't win Iowa, the plan was to just shelve it and keep following him in the Senate and wait, see what happened. If he did win Iowa, but didn't make it any further than that, we thought, well, we're going to try and convince someone there's a really great film in Iowa, which I still think there is, but, you know. So I honestly did not know until the Jefferson Jackson dinner. I started to think he could win Iowa, but then it just seemed, it was such a long and difficult race, and no one can ever count the Clintons out. They're really good at what they do. And Hillary was a really, really strong candidate. It did become apparent by the end of February when he ran up the numbers across. That's when, after Iowa, then they went to this 50-state strategy, where Plouffe is kind of like this rain man of delegates. He knew in his head every county how many votes they needed to get to tally up the number of delegates they knew. So by the end of February, you know, he spent time, and they spent time and money in states that the Clintons just ignored, so they could start this running up this tally of delegates, and figured that if they could get enough delegates that were allotted by votes, they could begin to convince the superdelegates. It would become inevitable that they couldn't go against the will of the people. So they felt more comfortable by the end of February and early March. It was a huge blow to lose Ohio and Texas. It was a huge blow to their morale, even though they knew they probably still had the votes and they actually ended up getting more delegates in Texas, even though they lost that primary, because they won. Texas has this weird, they call it the Texas two-step. They have a primary and a caucus, and they won more votes in the caucus. Once February was over, I felt like he was probably going to make it, but anything could have thrown it off. Jeremiah Wright could have thrown it off. So I was on tenterhooks, as Richard Wolff likes to say. Any others? All right, so I'm going to quickly move then into the last phase of Iowa, which was the turning point. This isn't in the film, and I think I love this scene. One of the things that you have to do when you're a filmmaker, unfortunately, is drop scenes that you love in order to make the story flow and to make your 700 hours 2 hours. So I really wanted to show this to you because it's an unusual thing to get a chance to see. So it begins with, before the Jefferson Jackson dinner, every state has them. It's a big fundraiser for the Democratic Party. The Republicans have them too. It's different people. I can't remember what the Republican one is called. And all the candidates come and speak. But before it, the staff, it tries to build up support. And this is in a big coliseum in Des Moines, and they just want to fill it with as many of their supporters as they possibly can. So they're rallying people, lobbying people to come to the JJ dinner. The people that pay a ton of money, sit on the floor at tables and have their rubber chicken dinner. And then the campaign supporters sit up in the nosebleed seats of the coliseum and are cued and to cheer when they're supposed to cheer. So again, it's that high school pep rally thing, which you're going to see a great example of, because before the Jefferson Jackson dinner, they have something called the sign wars, which start outside. Are you from Iowa? Okay, you did the same thing. Yeah, they start outside in the street where everybody has their little space staked out, and then the night before the dinner, they get to decorate the hall, and it's like an athletic competition. You get Tommy Vitor in his J-Lo red velour suit will explain a little bit of a to you in this clip. But, you know, they get teams of five. They get to run in. They run in. Everybody has tape all over their bodies because they're trying to tape signs on as many places as they can in the arena. And if they break a rule, they have to sit out. And it's you'll see. It's really a lot of fun. But this, in a very serious way, was the turning point for Barack Obama. And we've cut together a little bit of everybody's speech, so you get to kind of remember how many people there were running at that point. And I kind of, we didn't do this deliberately, but they all were a little dead, except for Hillary, until Obama came on. So here's the JJ dinner. This is a little bit longer clip. Oh, God. Wait. Okay.
His momentum just stalled at a certain point this summer. People are starting to question.
I'm sorry, this is a very short clip about the national polls.
Congratulations.
Then we're moving to the JJ dinner.
Everyone has been waiting to have answered this campaign is, when is Obama going to start moving in these national polls?
Senator Hillary Clinton's widening her lead with a 30-point lead. I have to ask. Does it concern you at all?
I mean, we're having a good time in Iowa. You know, the national poll story will run, sooner or later, has to run itself out. At some point, there'll be the first actual vote.
I think these polls can change. I think he's not in the best position to win, but he's by no means is he not in the position to win. The strength of Obama's calling card is he's a community organizer. This campaign is his laboratory for.
There's going to be a group stretch. that is literally in the TikTok. Yeah. I'm really excited.
I got black.
You guys getting excited for the big dinner?
I am.
You are?
Yeah.
Speech already?
Have written it.
Oh, yeah. Well, go to the sign board.
The other people worry about that. Our guy gets up there and just speaks from the heart.
Oh, the back is the best part. I was puff painting at like 2:30 in the morning, and I was like, I must be crazy. I don't know why I'm not sleeping, but it's fun.
Here's what you really need to get at the sign wars. Tommy B right now is dressed in a full red velour track jacket, track suit.
It's pretty awesome.
The whole world needs to see that, so you're going to need to.
He won't be hard to spot, I'm sure.
Come on.
I guess. Nope, yeah.
Way to show your scenery.
This is the pre-JJ sign war. So we have hundreds, if not thousands, of signs that are allowed in the upper hallways of the arena. There are very strict rules. You can't put on an exit sign. You can't put it on anywhere in the arena. You can't put it on a bathroom. Otherwise, you get a 5-minute timeout, and we all have to come down here. Five people at a time are allowed in. These are our credentials. And we have five shifts of five. I'm in the starting group. As you can tell, we take this way, way, way too seriously.
Two people going up, right?
Imagine you and I just ran around the arena, just arms out.
I'm fired up!
Ready to go! Ready to go!
Fired up!
Ready to go!
about 4,000 in the pre-rally, and we think of the 9,000 people going to JJ tonight, 3,000. We know 3,000 are all folks. 3,000 are all folks. As you can see.
The American people are not afraid. They're not afraid of any of the problems we face. They have more grit. They have more gumption. They have more courage than either political party gives them credit for.
Most of America will see us, the presidential candidates, in 30-second sound bites on television. Not you. You're going to see us up close, in your living rooms, in your town halls. You're in a place to judge who is trustworthy.
Salute the most important people here. Not all the politicians and political leaders, but the activists, the grassroots caucus goers of Iowa. Thank you again for making democracy look strong.
We're getting closer to the Iowa caucuses. They're going to be earlier than ever before. And I know as the campaign goes on that it's going to get a little hotter out there. But that's fine with me, because you know, as Harry Truman said, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen.
But it's been pointed out to you here, in 54 days from tonight, Iowans are going to gather in some 2,000 precincts throughout the 99 counties of this state and make your choice as to which one of us ought to be the candidate for President of the United States.
If we are really serious about winning this election, Democrats, then we can't live in fear of losing it. This party, the party of Jefferson and Jackson, of Roosevelt and Kennedy, has always made the biggest difference in the lives of the American people when we led not by polls, but by principle. Not by calculation, but by conviction. When we summoned the entire nation to a common purpose, a higher purpose. And I run for the presidency of the United States of America because that is the party that America needs us to be right now. Everybody. Thank you. Thank you. I'm wondering if you're
That moment where Michelle and Hillary were talking had aides and assistants scrambling nervously. They were like, what's going on? What's going on? What's going on? And it turned out that they were talking, that Michelle was actually asking her about raising Chelsea in the White House and how she managed to protect her from, how they raised such a great kid and managed to protect her from the glare of the political spotlight. And so I'm sure Hillary's still giving her advice on that. That's so that's, thank God, the technical portion of the program is over. that was kind of what turned it in Iowa. The next day, they had a lunch, a breakfast for the supporters. The organizers got to invite a lot of their parents out to the Jefferson Jackson dinner. And they had a really nice event where Obama met all the parents and talked to them and sort of got them inspired and then basically told them, you know, I'm sorry, but you're not going to get your kids for Christmas. You're not going to get your kids for New Year's. This is it. And we went back a couple days later. Actually, from that point on, Amy and I basically moved to Iowa and stayed there through the caucuses. The supporter cards just started trickling in. The organizers in the offices were telling us that things just started moving and just didn't kind of stop until... And then right after Christmas, thousands of volunteers from all over the country descended on Iowa for all the campaigns and just went door to door and phone banked. And the Des Moines Register endorsement came out before Christmas, and it was for Hillary, and that was a little bit of a blow to the Obama campaign. But then on New Year's Eve, the Des Moines Register does a poll that everyone kind of looks to as a predictor. And Obama won that poll. But Paul Tews, who had been in Iowa before, said, you know, this isn't over yet, everybody. You got to go out there and work for the... He gives a great speech, I think, in the movie. Go out there and work for the next 3 days. You know, we need every supporter. And they pulled it off. And, you know, only to march into New Hampshire and have their comeuppance, which was a good, I think, a good lesson for the campaign, that it wasn't going to come easily. So, I mean, obviously you all know what happened next. But this is how it started, and this is a part of the country that I think a lot of people don't realize how much actually goes on in Iowa. And so I think everybody should go, even if you can't go out and work there, go watch a caucus. Anyone can go in and watch a caucus. And it's pretty fascinating. And you hear all these jokes about how, you know, somebody will come over and say, you know, if you caucus for Obama, I'll mow your lawn all year and da 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 da. And it really isn't like that. It really is, though, neighbor to neighbor trying to tell their friends and neighbors why they support whatever candidate they support. It's democracy in action, even though you don't expect people to be up front. You know, you're supposed to have your secret vote, but somehow these people don't mind. So I would love to take questions about the rest of the campaign. Anything, really. He's a really nice guy. People ask that a lot. But he's not warm and fuzzy.
After Iowa, did you feel like you had to hew to a more sort of conventional narrative, right? Because then you have she cries in New Hampshire, and he loses in New Hampshire, gives a great speech. And did you feel like you had more sort of liberty with the Ohio sections of the Iowa sections of the film? And how did you deal with that as a filmmaker?
Yeah, I could have made the whole film about Iowa. It was harder. We did have to sort of... A narrative unfolded in the national arena that we had to follow and capture. But we also had a problem, and though this ultimately helped us, in that while we were trying to stay away from the daily news cycle, we wanted to capture, obviously, what was happening and all the ups and downs. And we initially had a four-hour cut with, like, every primary, and it was going up and down and up and down. And we realized the arc of the campaign, you know, we could capture that roller coaster with just a few of the ups and downs. But Barack Obama is not, as a subject for a film, the guy doesn't register a ton of emotion. He is that cool, calm, collected guy. And so, you know, you have to sort of find your film in what you're shooting. And we realized that the emotion of the story was really being carried by these organizers. And so we followed some of the ones that we'd met in Iowa to the various states they went to. And that really determined our narrative from there on out. Because also, reporters told us, it's also going to get a lot less interesting because he's going to land in four states a day and give the same speech. And, you know, they're basically trying not to mess it up. And so we spent a lot of time with the organizers. We'd go to debates, and we showed up all the time. But we found the real heart of our movie with the organizers. And then Axelrod was a great character as well. He really kind of... But I think it was really... I think the emotion of the story was really on the ground. That was the story of this campaign. You look at a film like The War Room, and that was the first time we saw strategists. You know, and Carville is such a colorful character. But we didn't know that story before, and now strategists are on TV all the time. So that wasn't necessarily going to be that interesting, nor that accessible, actually, to us, to be perfectly honest. Or you look at Journeys with George, and that was basically about one reporter's relationship with Bush. But it told the story of that campaign, too, in a really interesting way, and how the press kind of... maybe didn't take him to task the way they should have, didn't push. They were having a really good time on the plane. So we found it in the people.
I've been interested in politics since, you know, I was the weird freshman in high school wearing a Carrie Edwards button, but was it just a conscious decision to follow the 50-state strategy? That has been one of my most things I've loved about the Democratic Party, but how did that come about in this campaign?
That was Plouffe realizing that the only way that they could do it was to fight for every single vote that they could, and to use that organization principle to get on the ground in as many places as they could. So... yeah, it was his plan from the beginning. And, you know, it was funny because there would be times when the press would be saying one thing and the campaign would be like, you know, we got a plan, we're sticking to our plan, we're not gonna waver from our plan. And they got a lot of pressure, especially when the campaigns merged after the... because they employed the 50-state strategy again in the fall. They went after states that Democrats hadn't won in ages. And... a lot of the Clinton campaign people that sort of were more old school were like, why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? You know, we've got to go after this. We've got to do it this way. And they were like, no, we're sticking to our guns. And the one time that we actually did help the campaign, we tried very hard to say, you know, we're not going to release anything until after. This is a record of history. This is not to get him elected. But they wanted some footage of ours from Iowa to show to some of their new supporters at the DNC. Some part of their National Finance Committee, to show them that grassroots strategy had worked once and to let them sort of, I think, to get them excited about that idea again. So it was, Plouffe's a genius.
We have time for two more questions.
I have a question. Joe Biden was right there campaigning in the beginning. At what point did the Obama campaign begin to look toward Joe Biden as the potential vice presidential candidate, and why?
I don't know the answer to that. I can only speculate. I mean, I know as soon as... I know they started thinking about who a potential VP candidate could be in as early as May, but it really began in earnest vetting people over the summer. I think it politically, it just... I know Sebelius was really strongly considered, but I just think that they felt like maybe having the first African-American candidate was all the risk the party could bear at that point, and they had to go with someone with experience and with, you know, the white guy. I think she was considered, but she didn't want the and I don't know if this is true. This is the story that I've heard, is that she didn't want to be vetted. She said, you know enough about me already. And they didn't want to, you know, everybody knows everything there is to know about the Clintons. But they didn't want to take someone who didn't want to be vetted. Now, it may have been her way of saying no. I don't really know. I think she's, personally, and I'm not a pundit, and I'm not a political scientist, I think she's doing an amazing job where she is right now. Like, I think she's probably way more useful to the administration as Secretary of State than she would have been as VP. But, and I haven't read Pluff's book. I know it goes into it a little bit, so...
As a filmmaker, I was wondering if you could talk about what you took away from this project, maybe what the best part was, what the worst part is, and what you will, you know, apply to future projects.
The best part for me was Iowa, which is why I love talking about it. The access was great, which as a filmmaker you always want. Access, you know, it was before there was so much Secret Service and so much press that it just became hard to do anything. And I don't think I would ever be able to make a film quite like this again, though, because it's grueling and you never know where they're going to be next. You know, we were trying to plan. We weren't like the press that would just sign up for 2 weeks and go on a unlimited bank account wherever the campaign would take them. We had to sort of try and plan and figure out when we could be, you know, what would serve our story. And we did begin to realize that we didn't have to be there all the time because, yes, it is very repetitive and there is a story. The story isn't what happens every moment, what happens every day. You know, there's a lot of emphasis in campaigns today on winning the daily news cycle. But that doesn't necessarily matter for a film. So I learned I'd never do it again, but I think my takeaway too was I'd spent a lot of time doing cultural documentaries the last 10 years, and it did well. I don't feel like this film is an activist's film because it really is more of a record and it's from the inside and it's not presenting, a choice, you know, it's not, we don't really talk about the issues, we just show how it happened and how it unfolded. It made me more committed to making films that can potentially have an impact. Well, I still like entertaining people, and I wouldn't rule out that. There's so many people across this country going through so much that on the coasts you don't think about or hear about, and, you know, and the coasts dominate the media. I do feel like there's stories in this country that need to be told that haven't been told that I want to try and unearth. There's a guy over there.
This is more of a personal opinion question. From hearing you speak, it seems like you're very enthusiastic about grassroots work, about, I guess, citizenship, about people actually becoming active in politics. And, of course, this election was unprecedented in that aspect. But the big question is, of course, will that continue in future elections? And there's been a lot of debate over that. So do you have any thoughts over whether people start becoming apathetic again or...
I think that to a certain degree they have. I think the problem is that we feel like once we get someone elected, our work is done. And it's also for both the candidate. I mean, I think governing is a lot harder than running because when you're running, it's all ideas and aspiration. And it's the same thing when you're working on an election. You're working towards one goal. We want to get people to vote for this person. Whereas once you get into the messy business of governance, it becomes a like, well, just send the DNC money or send this organization money and we'll work on this issue. It's a lot harder to figure out what to do. So I think, yeah, people do become apathetic again. And I think people were really burned out after this campaign, which is one reason why, you know, when I say I want to do maybe more films that can have an impact, there's a lot of ways that media is being used now around particular issues. I think it has to start on a really local grassroots basis, because I don't know. I think it's really hard for people to influence Congress in ways other than voting them in. You know, you can send letters and show up at town halls and town meetings when they come back to their, but I think money has corrupted the whole process. they're just, all they want to do is raise money for their next campaign. So I'm discouraged, but I also see that there are some openings and ways to be a citizen that are maybe on a smaller scale than I initially thought.
We have time for one more question.
Hi, my name is Alan, and I worked on the campaign in Pennsylvania and Virginia. And from where I was organizing, it seemed like there was a lot in common in South Central Pennsylvania with rural Virginia and other places. I was also briefly in North Carolina. And I guess I wanted to ask you if you would speak to whether you thought that Iowa was an aberration or really was part of the pattern. I have an opinion on this issue, but I wanted to hear your thoughts on that.
It's sort of a double-edged sword, because the people that caucus are already people that are activists and are interested in politics. It's not, you know, a lot of people would say it's not the majority of the population of Iowa that caucuses. But the issues that they're talking about and they're facing, and everyone says when they hear activists, they think like crazy left-wing whack jobs. And they're not. It's not that. It's that just that they are politically active and aware, and they have a variety of views. The issues that they were interested in, jobs, healthcare, they were facing the same economic challenges that I think a lot of people around the country face. Immigration, which surprised me. There's immigration's a big issue in Iowa because there's a lot of illegals working in meatpacking factories and trying to figure out how to deal with that. And the farm town's dying. I think personally probably we spend too much time on farm subsidies and too little time on real reform in our farm policy, but that's personal opinion. So there is a certain amount of representativeness in the issues that people are dealing with. I don't think, though, that they're completely the same as the voters and other. They're better. They're more informed in a way, which is maybe a good thing and a bad thing. Do you know what I'm trying to say? I mean, they are a rarefied bunch of people. But they ask good questions and they do take it really seriously. So on that level, like, you can forgive them for getting this privilege and they're trying, I think, to think really hard about how everybody's impacted by, and them being first doesn't mean necessarily that anyone's going to win, but it does have an impact. What do you think? I'd be curious to hear.
I thought that that in many ways there was very little that was not expected when you went into a state that many of the organizers had already done work in other similar regions, not necessarily the same region, but places that had a lot of similarities. Rural issues tend to be pretty universal. The urban issues tend to have a lot of crossover. So I thought that it passed through there pretty easily. I do agree with you completely that in Iowa and New Hampshire as well, you have a lot of selection bias because of the rarefied nature. I was on the Dean campaign in New Hampshire and saw a lot of that where they got to know everybody. Mm-hmm. And completely agree with you.
Thanks. Thank you. Oh.
Please join me in thanking Alicia Sams. And this concludes tonight's event. Thank you very much.
Thank you all for coming.